This week on Disaffected, we continue the exploration of the private torment suffered by children of personality disordered parents. Because it isn't just personal and private, not anymore. The deranged characters we're going to talk about, my mother, Joan Crawford, and the fictional Margaret White, they're at large among us. Come with me and look inside the profoundly disturbed minds that have seized control of our culture. The personal has become political, and we need to wake up to it before it destroys our social fabric. And now, the second of our two-part episode.
You'll never know, dear, how much I love you. Please don't take my sunshine away.
Welcome to Disaffected. I'm Joshua Slocum. This is the show where we look at politics and culture through a psychological lens, and particularly through the lens of abuse dynamics and the kind of abuse dynamics that come from what are called cluster B personality disorders. It's my thesis, and it's the thesis of this show, that these personality disorders are heavily implicated in the politics and the culture of the left right now, particularly the social justice left, with its emphasis on things like critical race theory, the idea that we are living in an institutionally racist society, that everything is about a game of power over. And we try to show that these dynamics, these abuse dynamics, they come from the same place psychologically that abusive parents and abusive spouses do. I grew up in a household headed by a single mother who has borderline and narcissistic personality disorders. And when I finally realized what was psychiatrically wrong with my mother, what explained the abusive and deranged household that we grew up in 2016, I very quickly began to see that these same psychological maladies were popping out all over the place on the cultural left. I found that I had been part of basically a cult of social justice. My involvement with the atheist community, what was called New Atheism, and social justice activism, that had felt like a political and almost a personal home for me, was very, very deeply disordered, very destructive, and disordered and destructive in the same sorts of ways that the house I grew up in was. A little bit of housekeeping first. This is the second of a two-part episode, but I want to remind everybody that we are not only on the mainstream platforms. If you've watched any episodes of the show by now, you know that we tell it to you straight and we tell it to you blunt. This does not make us popular with platforms like YouTube, which are getting very censorious. So I want to make sure that you know that we are also on alternative media platforms. And a great place to see us, aside from YouTube, is Rumble. So if you want to look at our show on a platform that's probably not going to pull us the way YouTube is likely to, go to rumble.com/disaffected. That's DISAFFECTED. And I also want to say thank you. We had several new people who signed up to support us on Patreon. We can also be seen there, patreon.com/disaffected. Thank you very, very much for your support. We are just starting up and you are helping us pay the bills and we appreciate it. And if I haven't gotten to you by email personally, I promise you that I will this week. My producer and I both have day jobs, but we're really appreciative that you've taken the time and that you're putting some of your money to help make this show a success. And so for those of you who like what you hear here, see what a great host I am. I would say this, but honestly, I really think that you're getting an analysis here that you are not going to get on other shows. There are a lot of podcasts and there are a lot of talk shows out there right now that are also seeing the same problems with the social justice left. There are a lot of really good ones. I've plugged them and I'll plug them again. But our particular niche here is to tie in the psychology and the disordered thinking that is familiar to some of us from private domestic abuse and show you how those two things are connected. And you will not get that on any other show. So thank you very much for your support. I appreciate it. So like I said, this is part two of a two-part episode. And these two episodes are a little bit different than what you've seen in the past that we've done before. They're very personal. I'm going to be talking again quite a bit about my childhood, and I'm going to be using popular movie clips that exemplify the sort of character and personality disorder traits, particularly of the borderline personality disorder mother. So what I'd like to say is, I don't know who all of you are. I don't know how many of you came from abusive childhood backgrounds. I know that some of you did. Some of you probably didn't, thank goodness. But I do suspect that if you are watching this show because you too used to be a part of the social justice activist world, there's a fairly high chance that there's a reason you were in the social justice activist world. Many of us came out of abusive households. Many of us were drawn to what was sold to us as a movement for liberation and justice and fairness. And I described in the introduction that I want to show you what it looks like to be a child prisoner. And I think that many of you will know what that's like. Some of you won't. The people and the characters that I'm going to talk about in this show are the same sorts of people that are at the center of critical race theory, at the center of transgender ideology, at the center of the project to poison and maim and surgically mutilate gender nonconforming children, calling them trans children. The personal and the political really are the same here, just not the way you've been taught before. So if you're seeing this and you say, hey, Josh usually talks about, you know, he gives an example from what's going on in the news and then he ties it into something else. This is a little different. This is going to be mainly personal, but I don't want to lose you here. We are talking about the very same psychology. I'm inviting you to look at what happens behind closed doors. I'm inviting you to see the domestic and private side of the kinds of characters who are causing us so much trouble. So that's kind of how this ties together. In the first part of this two-part episode, I introduced you to a book called Understanding the Borderline Mother by Dr. Christine Ann Lawson. It is a magnum opus, and I don't think anything else out there comes close to the kind of in-depth examination of the psychology that forms parents like my mother, like Christina Crawford's mother, maybe like your mother or father. And she organizes the child's experience of the mother with borderline personality disorder into four categories, drawn from fairy tale archetypes: the waif, the hermit, the witch, and the queen. And we talked a lot about the witch, the wicked witch, in the last one. And there's some of that in this too. But I want to introduce you to the face of borderline called the queen, from Dr. Lawson's book, The Queen Mother. The darkness within the borderline queen is emptiness. Her inner experience is deprivation, and her behavior evokes compliance. She is demanding and flamboyant and may intimidate others. The queen feels entitled to exploit others and can be vindictive and greedy. The queen's emotional message to her children is, life is all about me. Does this sound familiar? I think it does, doesn't it? You see these people on Twitter, on Facebook, getting quoted by the New York Times every day. Justice for trans people, trans women's rights, you know, Black Lives Matter. All of these things, if you just look at them on the surface, they sound like things you could agree with. Who doesn't want fair treatment? Who doesn't believe in equality before the law? But what these people are asking for has nothing to do with equality. They don't want equality with you. They want to own you. What's yours is not yours. It's theirs. They are greedy. and entitled and empty. The frantic gesticulations, the pronouns, the wild hair, the outrageous over-the-top behavior, all of this, it's like one of those old comedy movies, like something out of Buster Keaton, but with less coordination. It's as if they're juggling dishes like a waiter in a restaurant, faster and faster and faster, and they're trying to put up a facade and a show to cover up the emptiness inside of them. And that emptiness is depthless. There is no bottom to it at all. And this is why they are so angry and so rage-filled, because they are trying to fill their empty souls with something. And that something comes from you. It comes from, if you're a woman, they want these so-called trans women, men, they want access not just to your bathroom at Macy's, not just to the changing room at Target. They want access to your rape shelters. They want to go to your women-only domestic violence shelters. All that's yours will be theirs. That's what this is about. And they will never stop. You have to understand this. They cannot fill that hole. This is a profoundly disordered mind that you are seeing. They will not stop once they get their stated goals. They will go farther and farther and farther. And I've been trying to think about how to get this across. There's a very thin line that separates political hunger and personal hunger for power from eroticism. Very, very thin line. I've noticed in watching some of these people, especially when they're able to whip up a crowd against another person. So when a group of trans women goes on Twitter and decides that a popular female author needs to be castigated or dethroned, stripped bare and made a mockery of, like trans people have done with Harry Potter children's author J.K. Rowling, calling her a TERF, trans exclusionary radical feminist, because she has the guts to stand up for women's rights and say, women are real. Female biology is real. The experience of being a woman and moving through the world has... moving through the world as a woman, that sex is real and that it does affect how safe you are, what needs you have, that women have particular legitimate needs that are not identical to men's. This is unacceptable to them because they don't want J.K. Rowling to exist. Anything she has, they want for themselves. And you can see it sometimes. These people take, frankly, an erotic pleasure in torturing other people. If you've ever noticed how gleeful they get when they whip up these crowds and when everyone is screaming, TERF, TERF, shame, shame. If it looks a little bit sexual to you, it's because it is a little bit sexual. I noticed the same thing in my own mother. I want to show you one more clip from the movie Mommy Dearest before we move into the movie Carrie. Kevin, can we cue up that scene where she takes her dolls away from her? Here we go.
Go to your room until
all I right, come. All right, so for those of you listening, this is a scene from Mommy Dearest. Christina, the daughter, is about to be punished, and we're seeing her, Christina, in her bedroom talking to her dolls
to
now.
Wake Mommy up like that. Very naughty. I told you, Mommy has to be beautiful today. This afternoon, she has to see Mr. Mayor. Today,
Joan Crawford is standing in the background.
You are selfish and thoughtless. You must learn to think about other people. You are bad, That spoiled children.
Christina gets out of the pool and goes back to her bedroom and finds that all of her dolls are missing. So she goes to her mother's bedroom.
My babies. Someone stole both my babies.
That's good, darling. They were thoughtless, selfish, spoiled children. Now they won't wake you up when you need your rest.
Christina turns and goes out of the room. Watch Crawford's face. Yeah, that. Did you see it? That glimmer of erotic satisfaction. The widening eyes. I'm telling you, people call this movie over the top and unbelievable. The only people who could say that are people who didn't grow up with a mother like this, because I'll tell you what, I've seen that very expression on my mother's face. There are a couple of times in my life with my mother when we had absolutely raging fights. And my mother would anger herself up. She'd stoke her own emotional overload. She got off on being angry. And the angrier she got, the more she liked it. And I've seen that expression on her face. And it comes right at the moment. It came right at the moment of my greatest anger and humiliation. When she would corner me, she'd either back me into a corner bodily, or she'd back me into a corner verbally. And just when I got to the point where I was almost unable to control myself. I mean, it's sick. You get into a dance with these people, right? My emotional pitch was just as high as my mother's. And I'd see it in her eyes. That glimmer. The quiver of the face. It looks like erotic pleasure because it is erotic pleasure. It is that sick. About a year ago, I wrote a very, very long letter to my mother, 6,800 words long. And I'm sure Kevin, my producer, is silently laughing and saying, yeah, you talk long too, buddy. And I didn't send it to her. I probably won't send it to her. I needed to do that for myself. But I tried to put my life with her in chronological order, and I tried to sort out, just like Christine Ann Lawson in Understanding the Borderline Mother, asks us to look at the four faces of the borderline through the archetypes of the waif, the hermit, the witch, and the queen. In my letter, I looked at my mother through the four faces of cluster B, the four cluster B personality disorders: borderline, histrionic, narcissistic, and antisocial. Antisocial is a synonym for sociopathic or psychopathic. I describe my mother as having both borderline and narcissistic personality disorders, but that's something of a shorthand. It's something of a compromise. The more I think about this, the more I think it may be more accurate to reduce people who have this psychology, instead of saying, well, there are four discrete disorders. I'm not so sure they're discrete. I think it may be more accurate to say this person's fundamental psychology is cluster B, but they have these prominent features. They have these from borderline. They have these from histrionic. They have these from antisocial. And that's going to mix for everybody. But I suspect that the baseline is what we call cluster B, and that some people, and my mother being one of them, cycle through all four so-called discrete disorders, depending on the circumstances they're in, and depending on, I was going to say their opponent, but really depending on their prey, depending on who their victim is. when I was a little kid, my mother could be the witch. She could beat me. She could scream at me. She could force me to confess things that I didn't do. That's harder to do once you get older. It was much harder to do after the last fight we had when I was a child, when I actually hit her. I slapped her across the face very hard. And she never laid a hand on me again. I taught her to fear me. I taught her that if she tried to come for me, that I would come for her, and that I was bigger than her now. Her affect changed after that. I saw the witch and the queen far less than I did before. And of course, at that point, I was out of the house. I was institutionalized in a group home during my teen years. And she started to act out the waif, the poor, misunderstood, very put upon single mother that the entire world had shit on. She elicited sympathy. She tugged at my heartstrings. She made me take care of her. It's much easier to manipulate a grown man with pity when you're no longer taller than he is, when you're not actually physically scary the way she was when I was a little kid. But when I wrote that essay, I said, Mother, I experienced you primarily as a borderline waif, while my sister experienced you primarily as a witch or a queen. And I don't think I was right. Because it started early. A few months ago, I got back in touch with my Aunt Vivian. My Aunt Vivian, that's not her real name, that's a pseudonym. My Aunt Vivian was the sister of my stepfather. My stepfather's name was Chuck. Chuck was the man that my mother married when I was between 3 and 4 years old. Chuck is the man who is the father of my younger brother and of my younger sister. So we share a mother, but we do not share a father. So my mother married Chuck and stayed married to him with him in the house for about 5 or 6 years, 5 or 6 very violent years, during which he not only beat me and beat my mother, but he tried to kill her one night in front of the children. And I'll talk about this maybe a little bit more in another episode. I know the question. I know the question you're asking right now because I get it. Why do you talk so little about your stepfather? Why do you talk about your mother so much? And in fact, I find this incredibly irritating. I've gotten that question a lot recently from women. Feminists, particularly radical feminists. It's not really a question. It's actually an accusation. And the accusation is, you're just a misogynist and you hate women because look, your stepfather tried to kill your mother, but all you do is talk about your mother. Whenever you want to talk about child abuse, all you talk about is your mother. I'll tell you why. I was there before Chuck came along, and I was there after he left. I never knew my father. He left while my mother was still pregnant. I never loved Chuck. I loved my mother when I was a child. I loved her, and I clung to her. But I never loved him, and I knew from the moment that he walked in the house that he didn't love me either. He didn't even like me. He strongly disliked me. There was never any love between us. There was nothing to grieve. I didn't care about his love. I was afraid of him. I was afraid for my mother. But he was just one of several men that came in and out of our lives. My mother, though, was my mother. There is no more primary bond than that between the mother and child. Fathers are important. They are. But the mother-child relationship is fundamental and primary. And that is why my attempt to understand our childhood, my attempt to understand why I became the person that I became, why I developed the problems that I did, why I developed the good character traits that I have, these are all fundamentally bound up with my mother. And back to reconnecting with Aunt Vivian. So Aunt Vivian was Chuck's sister. And Aunt Vivian was an anti-MAME figure. I'm not going to bother to explain that. If you don't know it, go look it up. Aunt Vivian and her husband and kids, my cousins, were a middle-class family. Uncle Marty ran a clothing store in a ritzy, beautiful little town in upstate New York, and they lived in an apartment above the clothing store, and they had the life. You know, they had a brand new 1978 Chevy Caprice wagon, top of the line, this gorgeous car that floated down the road that you could pile 16 kids into and go to the movies. They had a summer camp on a lake, and they made Christmases magical, absolutely magical, because they had money. They always had the best of everything. As soon as VCRs came out, Aunt Vivian's family had a VCR. When cable television came out, they were the first ones to have cable television. And thank God for Aunt Vivian, because we children had magical Christmases that we never would have had on the income that my parents had. She would send these huge boxes through UPS. We lived in California, and she'd ship them all the way across the country. These big boxes, like this big, full of beautifully wrapped presents. And they weren't just, I mean, we got school clothes this way, because remember, they ran a clothing store, but we also got that year's hot toy. When Walkmans came out, I got a Walkman. I mean, utterly magical. And when we were still in New York, they had us over for Christmas. And so when I was talking to Aunt Vivian a few months ago, it had been almost 10 years since we spoke. And we did a lot of catching up, and she said, "So are you reconciled with your mother?" Oh, no, I'm not. And I caught her up on what had happened in the past 5 or 6 years, and then she started to open up to me. So this was Christmas 1978. In that apartment above the clothing store, my mother had just gotten married to Chuck. And this ties back to what I was talking about in terms of, saying that I had primarily experienced my mother as a waify, needy borderline. And that wasn't true. So Christmas 1978, Aunt Vivian said, "This was the first Christmas that you spent with us. And I was the only child then. My sister hadn't yet been born." And she said, "Your mother brought you over, and we were having drinks, waiting for dinner to get ready, and she went into the other room, and you, Josh, were playing with your cousins, your two cousins, and your mother went into the room, and this is what she said. 'Joshua Lawrence Slocum, if you don't start playing nicely right now, I'm going to rip your fucking arms out of your shoulders and beat you with the bloody stumps.'" This was my mother when I was barely 4 years old. And Aunt Vivian said, "I tried to stay on your mother's good side. I never said anything that I thought would set her off, because she was my route to make sure I had to go through her to see you children. And I wasn't going to do anything to jeopardize that, because I was scared for you. I couldn't rescue you, but I could keep tabs on you." And thank God she did. It is true that my mother became more violent and more floridly abusive as I approached adolescence. And this is very common for children with abusive parents, parents with cluster B personality disorders. Christina Crawford said the same thing, that there were there were tender moments with her mother, and there were tender moments with my mother. Somewhere inside of her, my mother wasn't born the way she is, right? I think all of us are a combination of genetic predispositions and the environment that we grow up in, what our caregivers provide to us, what they do to us, what they don't do to us. But I don't think my mother was born the wicked person that she was, that she is. And when I was young, very young, you know, there were some good things that my mother did for us. We were always poor. And although I knew more about our finances and more about the troubles that beset my mother than I should have, this was part of parentification, right? Putting me in an adult role to emotionally caretake my mother. I mean, I knew the family budget from the time I was 7 or 8 years old. But she tried, at least in the beginning, to give us what she could give us, even though it didn't come in the form of money or new clothes. She read to us every night. The house was full of books. I got a library card when I was very, very young. And when I would ask my mother what a word meant, she would say, "You know where the dictionary is. Go look it up." "Oh, but why can't you just tell me?" She'd say, "You're smarter than that. You're smart, Joshua Slocum. Go look it up. You can figure it out from context." And I did. And because of my mother's attention to literacy, and because she instilled in us children a belief in our own innate intelligence and our own ability to work hard, I was reading at the 12th grade reading level in second grade. I remained at the top of my class throughout my school years until I dropped out of high school. And even when I went to college from 21 to 25, as hard as I partied, and I did party hard, I had a near perfect GPA. And I credit some of this to my mother, because she said to us, "We don't have money. We don't have a classy house. We're not one of those families, but we have smarts, and no one will ever take that away from you. You will always be intelligent. Use it." So there were tender times. But when your mother is a borderline, you can't trust them, because you never know when the weather is going to change, and you don't know why the weather changes. As I approached adolescence, my mother got more violent, more mercurial, and angrier. And she got angry because I was becoming my own person. I was developing my own opinions. I was saying no more. And they cannot take that. Christina Crawford talks about this with her adoptive mother, Joan, that she had those tender moments when she was a young kid too. And as she got to be 10, 11, 12 years old, and she was no longer a little doll that Joan could put in a pinafore and pose for photographs, that's when the rages really started. I want to show you another clip. And this is from the movie Carrie, the 1976 Brian De Palma film based on Stephen King's first novel, Carrie. And Carrie is nominally the story of a girl with psychic powers, with telekinetic powers. She can move things with her mind, who lives at home with the deranged religious fanatic of a mother. And as I said in the last episode, if you ask me to sum up my mother in pop culture terms so that you could instantly understand the kind of person she was, I would say that my mother was a plain and poor Joan Crawford crossed with Margaret White, Carrie's mother. My mother was not beautiful like Joan Crawford. She wasn't rich. She was plain and poor. And she was not a religious fanatic like Margaret White. But she had a great deal of Margaret White's affect and a great deal of the same kinds of torments and the way they express themselves. So let's look at this scene from Carrie.
You're a woman now.
Why didn't you tell me, Mama?
And God made Eve from the rib of Adam. And Eve was weak and loosed the raven on the world. And the raven was called sin. Said. The raven was called sin.
Why didn't you tell me, Mama?
Said.
No.
The raven was called sin.
Ooh, woman. And the raven was called sin.
And first sin was intercourse. First sin was intercourse.
I didn't sin, Mama.
No. Say it.
I didn't sin, Mama.
First sin was intercourse. First sin was intercourse. First sin was intercourse.
And the first sin was intercourse, Mama. I was so scared. I thought I was dying. And the girls, they all laughed at me and threw things at me,
And
Mama.
Eve was weak. Say it.
No, Mama.
Eve was weak.
No.
Eve was weak.
No.
Eve was weak. Say it.
No, Mama.
Say it.
Eve was weak. Eve was weak.
And the Lord visited Eve with a curse. And the curse was the curse of blood.
You should have told me, Mama. You should have told me.
Oh, Lord, help the sinning woman see the sin of her days and ways. Show her that if she had remained sinless, the curse of blood would never have come on her. She may have been tempted by the Antichrist. She may have committed the sin of lustful thoughts.
No, Mama,
oh, don't
no.
lie to me, Carrietta. Don't you know by now I can see inside you? I can see the sin as surely as God can.
No, Mama, you're
we'll
me.
Pray.
No!
We'll pray,
no,
woman.
No!
Pray to Jesus for
no,
a lustful no, sin
no,
inside
no,
God
no,
visited
no,
the curse.
No!
This was the
no, no, Mama! No, Mama!
I this no, the second curse. No, and this was the curse of childbearing. And he brought back pain and sweat and blood. Genesis 3.
I should have set that up for you before we played it. But for those of you who haven't seen the movie, that scene was about Carrie had just had her first period. Her mother had never told her what menstruation was. And Carrie had her first period in the girls' locker room at school and came home terrified and frightened. And that was her mother's reaction. We're going to take a break, and I'm going to come back and tell you about the significance of that scene and how I think it ties into the borderline derangement that's common to so many mothers like this. So, see you on the other side. Hey, listeners, guess what? We're on Patreon now. Bringing you this show costs money. Would you chip in to help? Go to patreon.com/disaffected. That's patreon.com/disaffected. DISAFFECTED. Thank you. Welcome back. So, in the last segment, we just watched that clip from Carrie. And that one is so reminiscent to me of the way my mother began to behave when I approached adolescence. Like I said, my mother was not a religious fanatic, but there was definitely a religious zeal. My mother created herself God in her own image, I guess is the best way to say it. She made herself God. This period between the time of 10 and 12 years old, I call these the yes, ma'am years. Just like Joan Crawford required her children to call her Mommy Dearest, my mother began requiring her children to address her as ma'am, and we were to have a very limited vocabulary. We could say yes, ma'am, or no, ma'am. And that was it. I don't know what set my mother off, but she raged one day and said, "You children don't respect me, You don't give me the respect that I'm entitled to as your mother. You have no manners. You talk back. I don't know who you think you are, but from now on, you are going to humble yourself before me. And just like in that scene, my mother would push me down onto my knees on the floor of the dining room in a rage. And she would get this look on her face. You can see why people used to look at those who had these disordered personalities and call them possessed. Because it really did look and sound like there was a demon inside of my mother. She would rage herself up. She'd get angrier and angrier. And then she'd bite her tongue like this. And then it was as if her mouth broke open and she would just scream and thrash and scream so hard that it sounded like she was hurting her vocal cords. And she pushed me down on the floor and she said, "Humble yourself before me. God damn you. Humble yourself. What do you say?" "Yes, ma'am." "What do you say?" "Yes, ma'am." "Say it like you mean it. Say it with a smile. Say it with a smile." My mother not only wanted to be respected, she wanted to be worshipped. And she took a sadistic pleasure in forcing her children to smile and to say that they were happy when they were not. Say it with a smile. Say it like you mean it. When these people scream at you on Twitter or on Facebook, or they show up at a book reading for an author that they don't think is sufficiently respectful of their trans rights or their person of color rights, and they scream and demand respect, they're doing the same thing that my mother was doing. They're not asking for respect, they're asking for obeisance. They want you down on your hands and knees, and they want you to lick the floor until you get to their boots, and then keep licking. They are empty inside, and they are full of rage. And they are trying to make themselves whole by emptying your soul out, too. When I was 7 years old, my mother worked at a 7-Eleven. In Fullerton, California, it's still there. It's on the corner of Garnet Lane and Placentia Avenue. And I used to go into the store after school because I went to Ruby Drive Elementary School. And it was about a mile. And in those days, children were actually allowed to walk places, which they should be now. So I walked back and forth to school every day. And this was just before I became a latchkey kid, but my mother worked as a manager at the 7-Eleven. And so I would stop in there on the way home and go read the comic books in the comic book aisle, or she'd give me a quarter to put into the Galaga machine, or I'd play Ms. Pac-Man. Sometimes she'd let me sit in the back room where the employees sat, where the CCTV cameras were, and all the scratch and dent Oreos that fell off the truck would find their way into the back. It was delicious. Well, one day, I was reading through the comics, and I had to go to the bathroom, and I didn't go fast enough. And I shit my pants. And I was utterly horrified utterly horrified. And I started screaming. Like mother, like son, right? And my mother came running over. And she looked down at me and she looked at my pants. Now, what do you think a normal mother would do if a child had an accident and soiled his pants? You'd probably take the child, comfort them, take them to the private bathroom, get them cleaned up. Not my mother. No. She grabbed me by the shirt and she started dragging me through the store, screaming, "How could you do this to me? How could you do this to me in front of everybody, in front of the world? What are you doing? What's wrong with you?" And she took me into the bathroom and she stripped me off and she dunked my underwear in the toilet and she slapped me. And she kept saying, "I don't know what is wrong with you. I don't know who raised you. What gave you the idea to do that to me?" That right there, that deranged misassignment of acting as though I had an evil intent, and that the fact that there was no recognition that I was embarrassed, that I was frightened, that I was a 7-year-old child who had shit his pants in front of other people in the middle of a store. I was crying in shame. She could not see it. I had done something to her. Notice that behavior in these activists too. Notice how they have no regard for your feelings or the feelings of anyone else around them. And anything that you do that triggers something in them, that reminds me of something that makes them feel scared or insecure, they start accusing you of doing something to them. That's the kind of thing that my mother did. That same year, we were eating dinner. And my mother was talking on the phone to one of her girlfriends at the kitchen table. And it was that phone, that yellow rotary dial Bell Systems phone with the cord that was super long so that you could go all the way into the other room. And she'd cradle the phone and flip her cards, shuffle her cards, talk to her girlfriends, smoke cigarettes while we ate. House was always full of cigarette smoke. We were not allowed to have food preferences, because there wasn't a lot of money for food, and what you got was what you were going to eat. And this is not actually something that I blame my mother for. She did not tolerate picky eating, and she was right not to. Because most of the time, children will learn, if they are exposed to a variety of foods, that most foods are palatable, even if they're not your favorite. And as a consequence, we were not picky eaters. We were not afraid of eating different kinds of food. But we were allowed no food preferences at all. Even things that disgusted us, we were not allowed to say no to. I had a disgust reaction to the texture of peas. The skins made me sick. I don't know why, but they literally made me nauseous. It was very, very difficult for me to swallow peas and pea skins without throwing up. I wasn't doing it on purpose. I just, it was a sensory problem. I don't know why. I love peas now, actually, but I didn't then. So my mother was on the phone and we were having peas with our meatloaf. And so what I would do to get through this, because you had to eat everything on your plate, I would squeeze the inside of the peas out inside my mouth. I'd eat the mushy middle. And then I would discreetly tuck the pea skins underneath my tongue so that I could slip away. If I could be excused from the table, then I could go to the bathroom and put them in the toilet and pretend I was going to the bathroom. And then my mother wouldn't know. And that day, she looked at me. And then she said into the phone, "Joanne, I gotta go." She hung up the phone. "Open your mouth." And she goes, open your fucking mouth. So she squeezed my mouth open. And she saw the peas under there and she backhanded me. What the fuck do you think you're doing? And then she pulled me into the bathroom, dragged me into the bathroom, said, go on, spit them out. And she smacked me repeatedly on the back of my neck as I choked these peas up until I was screaming. And she was screaming. And again, what do you think you're doing? Why are you doing this to me? Do you think I can't see what you're doing? Do you think I can't see inside you? Do you think I don't know what you're thinking? Go back to that. Think back to that clip we just watched when Margaret White was pushing Carrie down onto the floor and making her say Eve was weak. She said, I can see the sin inside you just as surely as God can. In our household, you had no privacy. You didn't even have the privacy of your own mind. My mother violated every boundary, even our own minds. They weren't allowed to be our own. And there were many episodes like this. There were times that she would make me stick my tongue out when I said something that I wasn't supposed to say, when I sassed or I talked back. I remember one time she came out of the bathroom. This is another thing of borderline mothers, folks. They have very poor sexual boundaries. When I was young, my mother used to walk around the house naked constantly. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just being a hippie mom. She did it far past the age when that was appropriate. And she would come out of the bathroom in a towel that just barely covered the top of her breast and barely skimmed over her private area. Saunter back to the bedroom, nonchalantly toss the towel off. Walk into the bedroom naked. And one day she came out of that steamed up bathroom half naked in her towel and said something to me, and I said something back to her, and she went back into the bathroom, took the bar of soap that she just used all over herself and brought it out, said, stick out your tongue, I'm going to wash out your filthy fucking mouth. And then she swiped the bar of Ivory soap down my tongue. Nothing makes sense when you are raised by a borderline mother. She can do things that you are not allowed to do. She can scream and swear and break dishes and refuse to pick up after herself. But if you should do any of those things yourself, God help you. God help you. And you notice that hypocrisy among some of the social justice warriors. As I say these things to you, I realize that, you know, you might be thinking, well, I don't see them doing these things. Well, you know, you won't see them doing exactly. These are the things they do to their children when you're not looking. These are the things that they do to their spouses behind closed doors. They can get really intimate and really dirty, and they can violate you behind closed doors in ways that they can't get away with in public. But their character is the same. They can throw tantrums, and nobody can gainsay them. Anybody who refuses to pay attention to it is invalidating them, not witnessing their pain. Anybody who makes a mistake and loses their temper is abusing them, but they can do it all back to you, and you can't say anything. That's cluster B. That's projection. I want to show you one more clip as we get to the end of this episode. This is also from Carrie. And I'm showing it to you because borderline mothers, sometimes you see the part of them that isn't fully corrupted. Sometimes a glimmer of what could have been a loving person comes through. Kevin, let's cue that up.
Mom? 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 Mom, stay, Mom. They left me. Mom, holy. Mom, please. Hold me, Mama. Please hold me.
I should have killed myself when he put it in me. After the first time, before we were married, Ralph promised never again. He promised, and I believed him. But sin never dies. Sin never dies. At first, it was all right. We lived sinlessly. We slept in the same bed, but we never did. And then, that night, I saw him looking down at me that way. We got down on our knees to pray for strength. I smelled the whiskey on his breath. The stink of the Roadhouse whiskey on his breath. And I liked it. I liked it. Well, all that dirty touching on his hands up on me all over me. I should have given you to God when you were born. And I was weak and backsliding. But now, the devil has come home. Oh. We'll pray.
Yes.
We'll pray. We'll pray. We'll pray. For the last time, we'll pray. Our Father, what man?
That's what you're afraid of. You're afraid that when you let her hold you, that she will kill you, that she will put a knife in your back, physically or emotionally. My mother would sometimes hold me when I was scared, comfort me, but often she'd be in the cuddliest mood after she'd been on one of her rages, and when I was ready to ask for forgiveness, when I was ready to say I was wrong and I should have listened all along, that's when she would hold me and stroke my hair and sing, "You are my sunshine." And you can't trust it. When people when people ask me, or when they say, I'm sure your mother loved you. I'm sure she just loved you in her own way. They need that to be true because they haven't seen this. They haven't lived it. They don't believe it's true. I don't know if my mother ever loved me. I don't know if she's capable of love. People with personality and character disorders like this, they may sometimes look very loving, but they can hug you and hold you and cry with you. And 5 minutes later, they're raging. My mother could hold me and sing me to sleep. And 3 hours later, I might be out of bed, back in the kitchen, re-cleaning the dishes, getting a wooden spoon broken across my ass, getting my ears boxed. And this scene, too, shows the sexual derangement. It's exaggerated a little bit, yes, but it isn't that exaggerated. My mother would tell me things about her sex life, about the men who'd been in her bed, especially if they were inadequate. You know, he was the most undersexed man I've ever had, Josh, she said about her husband. How do I wrap this up for you? We have to face the reality of the mental derangement that animates people who are causing us so many problems in our society right now. You know the phrase, fascism begins in the home? It's true. This is where it starts. This is where children learn to fear and mistrust other people. This is where they learn to be self-destructive themselves. Thankfully, I did not become as severely personality disordered as my mother. As I've said before, there was a time in my life when I might have been diagnosed with borderline personality or histrionic personality disorder. I never was formally. But I have some of those traits. I learned to mistrust. I learned to make enemies out of people who actually loved me. And I learned to cling and cleave to people who wanted to hurt me. I fell in love with men who hurt me. I had friends who exploited me. I didn't listen to people who said, there's something not right about him. I didn't listen because he felt like home. And if you had a raging, knockdown, drag-out fight, what did it matter? Because the love that made up for it afterwards was so good. This is trauma bonding. What Joan Crawford and Christina Crawford did was trauma bond together. What Carrie and her mother did, these fictional people, this is trauma bonding. And trauma bonding makes us think that the measure of a true and authentic love is how very badly it hurts and how deeply it cuts. And yet you're still there, and it feels so good to make up afterwards. These people can be seductive. These cluster bees, they play you. They're hot and cold. They love you one day, and then they hate you the next. And as much as they love you, as much as they build you up, they will tear you down that much too. That's the psychology of these people in the social justice world, at the center, and all the people around them, and maybe you've been one of them. You've been their abused children. You've been trying to earn their love and their respect. You've been trying to affirm them enough. You've been trying to validate them enough. If you just give them what they ask for, they'll finally feel okay, and they'll recognize everything you did for them. They won't. These people live their lives like they are trying to kill themselves, because they are really slowly killing themselves, and they will kill you too. Watch out. Thanks so much for listening. Would you take just a minute right now and share our show on social media? On Disaffected, we take a close look every week at the abuse dynamics exploding in the dark and disordered world that we live in. Tell other people about us. And when you subscribe, hit that notification bell and stay with us in real time as we take a new close look every week and examine how to identify and contend with the abuse dynamics at play in the world around us.